Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
This is APN 311, more commonly known as Qarziba, a cutting-edge pharmaceutical antibody used to treat complex illnesses in hospitals all over the world. This is manufactured by Aperion Biologics, an Austrian-based firm. The raw medicine is then loaded into a canister, like this one, and shipped to the Netherlands to be packaged, then onto Ireland for warehousing. It will then be sold wholesale to Beijing, who will label the product for individual markets in their plant in Guangzhou, before shipping it back to Ireland, which will in turn ship it to regional distribution centres, who will distribute it directly to hospitals, who will distribute it to doctors, who will distribute it into their patients' squishy, squishy organs. Yeah, I know, right? What's more is that this didn't even include the base chemicals needed to actually manufacture this raw medicine, and APN 311's supply chain isn't even an outlier in the pharmaceutical world. If anything, it's comparatively straightforward, but not as straightforward as making a product and then just shipping it to distribution centres. So why add all of this extra complexity? And don't think this is a weird quirk of the medical industry either. Everything from your fridge to your phone to the clothes you are wearing right now have likely been produced bit by bit in dozens of countries in hundreds of different factories involving tens of thousands of workers. If I were to ask you where iPhones are made, you'd probably turn around and say, well, China. But this isn't the whole story. The entire iPhone supply chain before retail distribution involves 43 countries, from battery lithium mined in Brazil to semiconductors printed in Taiwan, all the way down to really obscure things like those lovely little boxes, which are produced in the Czech Republic. So, when does this all get too much? Sure, there are comparative advantages to producing products in countries with good manufacturing infrastructure or low labour costs or, hey, even some nice tax policies. But at what point does shipping things back and forth across the world end up costing more than the cheap salaries you're able to exploit? Well, to find out, we're going to, as always, look at a few critical factors. How do companies come up with these intricate supply chains? Why are some of these supply chains so convoluted, where others are extremely straightforward? And will the severe restrictions put on international shipping during the fallout of the coronavirus make companies rethink how far they extend their supply lines? So the first thing to understand when looking at shipping maps like this one is the factors that can contribute to steps in the process that seem redundant. The first and most obvious one to address up front is that most companies actually don't manufacture their own products from beginning to end. A company like General Motors will of course make some parts in-house from raw materials, but even things like sheet metal are in turn purchased from steel manufacturers who purchase raw iron ore off the international commodities market. Taken a step further, using our example of the iPhone from earlier, we will find that Apple doesn't even handle the manufacturing at all themselves. Instead, they subcontract this process to Foxconn, who in turn deals with the cheapest suppliers they can find for individual components. The natural push towards more focused component manufacturing is a natural part of efficient production. Why bother making something yourself when it can be purchased from a supplier who specializes in making these components as cheaply as possible? But this raises the question of why anything at all would be manufactured outside of places like China, especially when it's a Chinese product like the medicine we explored earlier. Well, this is down to technology and regulation. This particular drug is manufactured in Austria, which is one of the most expensive places on Earth to produce something. But it's still made here because of extensive government contributions towards harbouring medical research in the nation. The trade-off is that any breakthrough treatment that is developed in one of the nation's sponsored facilities needs to be produced in Austria. This is still a win-win for the people of Austria and the pharmaceutical companies, though. The companies get a hotbed of medical research, which is to pharmaceuticals what Silicon Valley is to technology, and the people of the nation get a strong employer that pays people extremely well to perform a highly technical role. This also works well because things like pharmaceutical products are expensive. This one canister can easily contain millions of dollars worth of product, so the difference between paying a team $3,000 versus $15,000 to produce something like this is basically a rounding error. What's more is that this item is very cost-dense with very high profit margins, so paying to ship it all over the world in every which way is not going to have much of an impact on the end price, a price that is also most likely going to be paid by an insurance company or a government anyway, rather than a cost-conscious consumer. Compared to, say, an automobile, this kind of product making a few extra stops on the journey to its end destination is not a big deal. This should be pretty obvious to most people, but what you might not consider is the impact of mergers and acquisitions. M&A activity is at its highest point in history, with total deal volume recently surpassing the record high of $2.4 trillion set in 2007. Now, there is a lot to be said about what this means for the global economy, but one often overlooked impact is how it muddles supply chains. If a company buys another company that is either a supplier or distributor of their product, this is no big deal. This is called vertical integration, and in theory, the actual supply chain shouldn't change, except now it will all be managed by the acquiring company, which will make it look longer and more convoluted, but the products are really only doing what they would have done anyway. For example, suppose General Motors buys a steel mill. That hasn't added any extra steps to the process of manufacturing a car that wasn't there beforehand. In that case, it just means that the production of steel is now under the control of the supply chain managers at GM. However, if a company does what is called a horizontal integration, where they buy out a competitor, things can get more tricky. That competitor would have had a supply chain all of their own, and assuming that the purchasing business intends to keep the company running, this supply chain will need to be maintained, at least until such a time that the purchase company's processes can be effectively integrated into the purchasing company's processes, or vice versa. That's right. Sometimes companies will buy other companies exclusively to get access to their distribution networks. I don't know why I've decided to use this as an example, but think of Dunder Mifflin from The Office. In season 6, this fictional paper company got sold to a printer manufacturer specifically because the purchasing company wanted to use their distribution network to reach new customers. Dunder Mifflin was purchased despite being bankrupt specifically for their supply chain. This sort of stuff happens all the time in the real world, but it does create a problem. If the companies want to integrate this whole process into one succinct distribution system, they will need to make a lot of changes. They will need to expand some warehouses and close others. They will need to change barcodes, inventory numbers, computer systems, commission structures, and a host of other systems to merge how paper and printers get from suppliers to customers.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, this is possible, but it is extremely difficult, especially if you want to make sure that customers can still be serviced while this change is taking place. Many companies just don't even bother and resign themselves to running two systems in parallel for the different product lines. It's not the most efficient solution, but it avoids a lot of the effort and operational downtime. The ultimate result, though, is more convoluted supply chains. So two things here. The first is, yes, I am the most boring person in the world to watch comedies with because this is what I will be thinking about. And the second is that sometimes complexities are just an unfortunate byproduct of running and expanding a business. But all of these factors so far have not really been the decision of the company. An acquiring company would love to have just one single supply chain. Pharmaceutical companies would love to be able to produce medicine wherever they wanted. And of course, it's almost impossible for a company to control everything from raw materials to finished product. Although, don't tempt Elon, I suppose. Even still, there are times where these factors are not an issue and companies still choose to add extra bits and pieces to a global supply chain that don't look to be necessary. So then, why do companies add unnecessary moving parts to their supply chains? Well, there are actually a few things, but the big ones are skirting around taxes, lobbying, and genuinely minimising costs. That last point is probably the easiest to cover. On a large enough scale, even tiny cost advantages to producing products in one country over another makes it worthwhile to do so and just absorb the cost of shipping. This becomes more prevalent the more cost-dense something is. For example, something small and expensive like electronics or medicine can afford to skip along multiple destinations as it gets produced because it doesn't cost very much to ship something like this. Compare that to something like a raw commodity, and you will find that the same value of goods will be far heavier and far larger, therefore far more expensive to ship, minimising or eliminating any advantage of anything outside of going as directly as possible from the mine to the furnace to the end user. You wouldn't mine iron ore in Australia and then ship it to China to have it mixed with zinc and carbon before shipping it to Korea to be smelted into steel and then finally to Japan to be formed into rebar. I mean, you could theoretically do this, but you would be out of business very quickly, wasting that much shipping money on a heavy, low-margin product. Now, where this might start to make a bit more sense is in avoiding certain taxes. Countries have trade deals with one another, which will often mean that trade between the countries involved in said deals does not incur import taxes that are levied on most other countries. Import taxes can be steep and make a big difference in the final price tag of a product. Part of the reason why foreign cars have such a bougie connotation is because they have historically been far more expensive in most markets than locally produced alternatives. For example, in England, a new Corvette costs about as much as a new Aston Martin. However, if companies can move products around these trade deals, they can avoid these taxes altogether. Consider the medicine that we were studying earlier. Austria is part of the European Union, which means products can be traded between Austria and Ireland. Ireland is home to a specific duty-free zone, which we explored in our video on Ireland's economy. This zone means it can export goods to China with no tariffs to be packaged, and then suddenly, it's not an Austrian product, it's a product of China, which just so happens to contain an Austrian component. With its new designation as a Chinese product, it can now be distributed to any country that has made trade deals with China, which is a lot of them. Now, of course, this is a massively oversimplified example, and these companies don't actually disclose the exact systems that they use to work through these regulations, for obvious reasons. So, this goes to show, most people know that supply chain engineers design supply chains, but accountants and lawyers also have a big part to play. And so too do lobbyists. You see, manufacturers that rely on favourable government legislation or government dollars have been known to spread out their facilities over multiple election districts in order to be a more influential employer. If a party doesn't support a contract for, oh, I don't know, let's say a new fighter jet, then the involved company might have to shut down these facilities and lay off workers in crucial districts, creating enough laid off and angry workers to swing the next election. Vox did a fantastic video on exactly this phenomenon, and I'll leave a link to that in the video description if you want to learn more about that process in more detail. However, the ultimate end result of this is a supply chain that is needlessly spread out. Not because it makes economic sense to do so, but because it makes political sense to do so. This brings us on to maybe the most important thing to consider. Does all of this even make sense in the post-lockdown world? The answer is, of course, we don't know for sure yet. Global supply chains have been massively altered because of two opposing forces, the inventory bullwhip and the push to minimise stock. If one step in a supply chain is delayed for whatever reason, like let's say a facility had to be shut down due to a COVID case being contracted by one of its workers, then this affects all of the other steps in this process downstream from that factory. If an electrical insulator factory is shut down, then it means that a capacitor manufacturer is going to need to halt production until it can find a new supplier, which means circuit boards can't be produced to put on graphics cards, and then the proverbial whip crack will be that nobody can buy any graphics cards. Now, the solution to all of this would just be to keep more inventory on hand so that minor delays like this one can be filled in with spare stock to keep the whole machine chugging along. The problem with this, though, is that it is expensive. Take an example like Amazon. At the end of 2020, they had $24 billion worth of inventory on hand. If hypothetically they were able to half that amount, they would free up $12 billion, which could be reinvested into the future growth of the company or just invested into the market itself. If we assume a generous market return of 10%, that would be $1.2 billion that they could add as profit every year. Or, put another way, that would be a 5% increase in total net profit over their largest year on record. So yeah, to stock up or not to stock up, there really is no right answer, but COVID has certainly made a few companies ask the question once again.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.